Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. And tonight we're going to discuss the, continue our discussion rather on the, about the, from the stanzas of the Book of Dizan. And I'm going to go to that. If you looked at last week's program, or listened to it with Maria Fix-Algeri, we had a great discussion, and I urge you to go to last week's program to check it out. And I'm just checking something here. I re-edited this. I'm hoping it took. We're going to talk about the seven stanzas from the Book of Dizan and continue with the Night of the Universe, which we talked about last week, and then we'll move on. This is going to be a series on this book. I don't know how many programs I'm going to devote to it. It's quite an extensive work, but I think it would do good to bring it forward, and introduce it to my listeners. And again, I want to ask you to please go refer back to last Thursday's program. We covered this entire first part quite in depth, and we talked with Maria Fix-Algeri, who's a psychic and friend, and quite a scholar in this area, and Blavatsky's work. So, just to introduce this segment, Blavatsky's masterwork on Theosophy, covering cosmic, planetary, and human evolution, as well as science, religion, and mythology, based on the seven, based on the stanzas of Dizan, with corroborating testimony from over 1,200 sources. Originally published in 1888, Theosophical University Press electronic version, due to current limitations in the ASCII character set and for easy in searching, no diacritical marks appear in this electronic version of the text. Okay. The edition was corrected against the facsimile. So anyway, we get the point. I want to continue with this. The first volume, volume 2, it's called, Cosmogenesis. And we'll continue with that. And last night we read the first, last week we read the first stanza of Night of the Universe. Tonight we're going to read the idea of differentiation, which is stanza 2. Rested in bliss of non-being. The Manvantarikdhan, okay, essentially is the builders. The sons of Manvantarikdhan are the real creators of the universe. And in this doctrine, which deals only with our planetary system, they, as the architects of the ladder, are also called the watchers of the seven spheres, which esoterically are the seven planets. And esoterically, the seven earths, or spheres, are planets of our chain also. The opening sentence of stanza one, when mentioning seven eternities, is made to apply both to Mahakalpa, or the great age of Brahma, as well as to the solar pralaya, and subsequent resurrection of our planetary system on the higher plane. There are many kinds of pralaya, dissolution of a thing visible, as will be shown elsewhere. Now, these are still comments on that one stanza, by the way. Paranishvana, remember, is the summum bonum, the absolute, hence the same as Paranirvana. Besides being the final state, it is the condition of subjectivity. It has no relation to anything but the one absolute truth on its plane. It is the state which leads one to appreciate correctly the full meaning of non-being, which, as explained, is absolute being. And sooner or later, all that now seemingly exists will be in reality, actually in the state of Parishpana. But there is a great difference between conscious and unconscious being, and the condition of Parishpana without Paramartha, self-analysis. And it states, mothers of the gods, Aditi, or cosmic space, in the Zohar, she is called Sephira, the mother of Sephiroth and Shekinah in her primordial form, in Absconditu. So, again, you probably forgot what I just read. However, I'm going to go through that quickly again, and then we'll go on to part two. Again, the first stanza read, "We were the builders, the luminous sons of Manvantarikdhan, in the unknown darkness, in their Ahi, Paranishvana, produces a form from no form, the root of the world, the Divamatri and Shavatvat, rested in the bliss of non-being." Stanza 2. Where was silence? Where were the stars to sense it? No, there was neither silence nor sound, not save ceaseless eternal breath, motion, which knows itself not. The idea that things can cease to exist and still be is a fundamental one in Eastern psychology. Under the apparent contradiction in terms, there rests the fact of nature to realize, which in the mind, rather than to argue about words, is the important thing. A familiar instance of a similar paradox is afforded by chemical combination. The question whether hydrogen or an oxygen cease to exist when they combine to form water is still a moot one. And some arguing that since they are found again when the water is decomposed, they must be there all the while. Others contending that as they actually turn into something totally different, they must cease to exist as themselves for the time being, but neither side is able to form the faintest conception of the real condition of a thing which has become something else and yet has not ceased to be itself. Existence as water may be said to be, or oxygen and hydrogen, a state of non-being, which is more real being than their existence as gases, and it may faintly symbolize. And hence, non-being is absolute being. In esoteric philosophy, in the tenets of latter, even Adi Buddha, first of the primeval wisdom, is, while manifested in one sense an illusion, Maya, since all the gods, including Brahma, have to die at the end of the age of Brahma, and the abstraction called Parabrahm alone, whether we call it Ensof or Herbert Spencer's unknowable, being the one absolute reality, the one soundless existence is Advaita, and without a second, and all the rest is Maya, teaches the Advaita philosophy. The absolute knows itself not. The condition of the universe, when it goes to sleep or ceases to be during the nights of Brahma, to awaken or reappear again when the dawn of a new Manvantara recalls it to what we call existence. And the breath of the one existence is used in its application only to the spiritual aspect of cosmogony, as by Asiatic esotericism. And otherwise it is replaced by its equivalent in the material plane, motion. The one eternal element, or element containing vehicle, is space, dimensionless, in every sense. So, every sense coexists with each, with which are endless duration, primordial, hence indestructible matter and motion. Absolute perpetual motion, which is the breath of the one element. This breath, as seen, can never cease, nor even during the prelaic eternities. But the breath of the one existence does not all the same apply to the one causeless cause, or the all-beingness, in contradiction to all-being, which is Brahma, or the universe. Brahma, or Hari, the four-faced god, who, after lifting the earth out of the waters, accomplished the creation, is held to be only the instrumental and not as clearly implied the ideal cause, and no Orientalist so far seems to have thoroughly comprehended the real sense of the verses in the Purana, the treat of creation. Therein, Brahma is the cause. Now, remember, these are footnotes and commentaries of this particular stanza, which I just read. Therein, Brahma is the cause of potencies that are to be generated subsequently for the work of creation. When a translator says, "And from him proceeds the potencies to be created after they had become the real cause," and from IT proceeds the potencies that will create as they become the real cause, or the material plane, or would perhaps be more correct. Save that one ideal cause, there is no other to which the universe can be referred. Worthiest of aesthetics, through the potency of that cause, that every created thing comes by its inherent or proper nature. If in the Vedanta and Naya, Mata is the efficient cause, as contrasted with Upadana, the material cause, and in the Shankaya, Pradhana implies the functions of both. In the esoteric philosophy, which reconciles all these systems, and the nearest exponent of which is the Vedanta, as expounded by the Avyata Vedanta is, none but the Upadana can be speculated upon. That which is in the minds of the Vaishnavas and the ideal in contradiction to the real, or Parabrahm and Isvar, can find no room in published speculations, since that ideal, even in a misnomer, when applied to that of which no human reason, even that of an adept, can conceive. So, you know, I guess what's impossible, so hard for us to, and of course the language and the interpretation is difficult, trying to comprehend the, there's not even a word for it, really. Gravity, the the greatness, the size, the impact, the there's really no word that can describe the immensity of what became at the beginning of the universe, you know, and how it all began, how it was all conceived and decided upon and happened. It's just boggles everybody's mind, you know, for eons, you know, eons, and been around. You know how it all started. And mythology has crept up around it, and religions, and philosophies. Man, just, you know, just tons of stuff has crept up around the trying to explain the unexplainable. And so doing, I guess the night of the universe is just as clear as anything else we've studied. And let's go on. I'm going to go to stanza 2. Continued. The hour had not yet struck. The ray had not yet flashed into the germ. And the Matre Padma, or Mother Lotus, had not yet swollen. So, in other words, this is obviously referring to pregnancy. There's nothing, you know, grown yet. The ray of the ever darkness becomes, as is emitted, a ray of effulgent light or life, and flashes into the germ. And the point in the mundane egg, represented by matter in its abstract sense. But the term point must not be understood as applying to any particular point in space, for a germ exists in the entire of every center of every atom, and these collectively form the germ, or rather, as no atom can be made visible to our physical eye, the collectivity of these, if the term can be applied to something which is boundless and infinite, forms the noumenon of eternal and indestructible matter. One of the symbolic figures of the dual creative power in nature, matter and force on the material plane, is Padma, the water lily of India. The lotus is the product of a heat and water, vapor, or ether. Ether standing in every philosophical and religious system as a representation of the spirit of deity, the active male generative principle, and ether, or the soul of matter, the light of the fire, for the passive female principle from which everything in this universe emanated. Hence, ether or water is the mother and fire is the father. Sir W. Jones, and before him, archaic botany, I show that the seeds of the lotus contain even before they germinate. Contain an embryo. Oh, I'm sorry. Lost my place here. The seeds of the lotus contain, even before they germinate, perfectly formed leaves. Excuse me. The miniature shape of what one day, as perfect plants, they will become. In nature, thus giving us a specimen of the perforation, preformation of its production. The seed of all phanerogamous plants, bearing proper flowers, containing an embryo plantlet ready formed. Lotus flower is a universal symbol. This explains the sentence, the mother has not yet swollen, the form being usually sacrificed to the inner or root idea in archaic symbology. The lotus of Padma is, moreover, a very ancient and favorite. Stanza 2 continued, paragraph 4, or line 4, I should say. It states, her heart had not yet opened for the one ray to enter, hence to fall as 3 into 4 in the lap of Maya. And Maya means the primordial substance had not yet passed out of its pre-cosmic latency into differentiated objectivity, or even become the two-man, so far invisible, protile of science. But as the hour strikes and it becomes receptive of the phohatic impress of the divine thought, the logos, or the male aspect of the anima mundi, its heart opens. It differentiates, and the 3, father, mother, son, are transformed into 4. Herein lies the origin of the double mystery of the Trinity and the Immaculate Conception. The first and fundamental dogma of occultism is universal unity, or homogeneity under 3 aspects. This led to a possible conception of deity, which as an absolute unity must remain forever incomprehensible to the finite intellects. If thou wouldst believe in the power which acts within the root of a plant, or imagine the roots concealed under the soil, thou hast to think of its stock or trunk, or of its leaves and flowers. Thou canst not imagine that power independently of these objects. Life can be known only by the tree of life, the idea of absolute unity. The idea of would this is saying the idea be broken entirely in our conception had we not something concrete before our eyes to contain that unity. And the deity being absolute must be omnipresent. Hence, not an atom, but contains it within itself. The roots, the trunk, and many branches are 3 distinct objects, yet they are one tree, says the Kabbalist. The deity is one because it is infinite. It is triple because it is ever manifested. And this manifestation is triple in its aspects, for it requires, as Aristotle has it, 3 principles for every natural body to become objective, privation, form, and matter. Privation meant, in the mind of the great philosopher, that which occultists call the prototypes impressed in the astral light, the lowest plane and world of anima mundi. The union of these three principles depends upon a fourth, the life which radiates from the summits of the unreachable to become an universally diffused essence on the manifested plane of existence. And this quaternary, father, mother, son, as a unity and a quaternity as a living manifestation, has been the means of leading to the very archaic idea of immaculate conception, and now finally crystallized into a dogma of the Christian Church, which kernelized this metaphysical idea beyond any common sense. For one has but to read the Kabbalah and study its numerical methods of interpretation to find the origin of that dogma. It is purely astronomical, mathematical, and preemptively metaphysical. The male elements in nature, personified by the male deities and Logi, Viraj, or Brahma, Horus, or Osiris, etc., is born through, not from, an immaculate source, personified by the mother, because the male having a mother cannot have a father. The abstract deity being sexless and not even a being, but Venus or life itself. Let us render this in the mathematical language of the author, the source of measure, speaking of the measure of man and his numerical Kabbalistic value. He writes that in Genesis, it is called the man, even Jehovah. Okay, so this gets kind of hairy. It gets the mathematical formulas. I'm going to skip this. Just move on down the line here to the next. To the next stanza. The seven sons were not yet born from the web of light, and darkness alone was father, mother, Shvababat, and Shavash, and Sababat was in darkness. The secret doctrine in the stanzas given here occupies itself chiefly, if not entirely, with our solar system, especially with our planetary change. The seven suns, therefore, are the creators of the latter. This teaching will be explained more fully hereafter. Stanza 2 is continued. This is line 6. These two are the germ, and the germ is one. The universe was still concealed in the divine thought, in the divine bosom. And the note on this is, the divine thought does not imply the idea of a divine thinker. The universe, not only past, present, and future, which is human and finite idea expressed by finite thought, but in its totality, the sat, the absolute being with the past and future crystallized in the eternal present, is that thought itself reflected in the secondary manifest cause. Brahma, neuter as the mysterium magnum or Paracelsus, is an absolute mystery to the human mind. Well, Brahma, the male, female, is aspect and anthropomorphic reflection, is conceivable to the perceptions of blind faith, though rejected by human intellect when it attains its maturity. The statement that during the prologue, so to say, of the drama of creation, for the beginning of cosmic evolution, the universe or the sun lies still concealed in the divine thought, which had not yet penetrated into the divine bosom. And this idea, note well, is at the root and form the origin of all the allegories about the sons of God born of immaculate virgins.
Substance
its periodical shadow from its own plane into the lap of Maya. It implies that this expansion, not being an increase in size, for infinite extension admits of no enlargement, was a change of condition. It expanded like the bud of the lotus for the lotus. Plant exists not only as a miniature embryo in its seed, a physical characteristic, but its prototype is present in an ideal form of the astral life from dawn to night and during the Manvantaric period. Like everything else, as a matter of fact, is this object universe from man down to mite, from giant trees down to the tiniest blades of grass. All this teaches the hidden science, but is but temporary reflection. The shadow of the internal ideal prototype in divine thought, the word eternal. Note, while again standing here only in the sense of eon, as lasting throughout this seemingly indeterminable but still limited cycle of activity called by us Manvantara. For what is the real esoteric meaning of Manvantara, or rather Manu Antara? It means esoterically between two manas, or of whom there are 14 in every day of Brahma. Such a day consisting of 1,000 aggregates of 4 ages, or 1,000 great ages, Mahayugas. Let us now analyze the word or name Manu. Orientalists in their dictionaries tell us that the word Manu is from the word man, or to think, hence the thinking man. But esoterically, every Manu is as an anthropomorphized patron of his special cycle around is but the personified idea of the thought divine. Each of the Manu, therefore, being the special god, the creator, and the fashioner of all that appears during his own receptive cycle of being on the Manvantara. Phohat runs the Manu, or the Dhyan Kohans, and Aaron, and causes the ideal prototypes to expand from within and without, to cross gradually on a descending scale all the planes from the new moon to the lowest phenomena, to bloom finally on the last and full objectivity, the acme of illusion, for the grossest matter. Okay, in stanza 3, number 2, sentence 2, the vibration sweeps along, touching with its swift wing the whole universe, and the germ that dwelleth in darkness, the darkness that breathes, moves over the slumbering water of life. Chapter, stanza 3, part 2. Darkness radiates light, and light drops one solitary ray into the waters, into the mother deep. The rays shoot through the virgin egg. The ray causes the eternal egg to thrill and drop the non-eternal germ, which condenses into the world egg. Solitary ray dropping into the mother deep can be taken as meaning divine thought or intelligence impregnating chaos. This, however, occurs on the plane of metaphysical abstraction, or rather the plane wherein that which we call a metaphysical abstraction is a reality. virgin egg being, in one sense, abstract eggness, or the power of becoming developed through fecundation, is eternal, and forever the same. And just as the fecundation of the egg takes place before it is dropped, so the non-eternal periodical germ, which becomes later in symbolism the mundane egg, contains in itself, when it emerges from the said symbol, promise and potency of the universe. I think I'm going to skip off of that one and go next to the sentence 4. Then the 3, the triangle, fall into the 4, which are the quaternary, and the radiant essence becomes 7 inside, 7 outside, and the luminous egg, which in itself is 3, curdles and spreads in milk white curds throughout the depths of mother, the root that grows in the ocean of life. The use of geometrical figures and the frequent allusions to the figures in all the ancient scriptures sees in the Book of the Dead and even the Bible must be explained in the Book of Bizan as the Kabbalah. There are two kinds of numerals to be studied, the figures, often simple blinds, and the sacred numbers, the value of which are all known to the occultists through initiation. The former is but a conventional glyph, the latter is the basic symbol of all. That is to say, that one is purely physical, and the other purely metaphysical, and the two standing in relation to each other, as matter stands to spirit, the extreme poles of the one substance. Breath, which alone could organize the physical cosmos, where not obtains its form, but through the deity, which is an effect of number. It is instructive to quote Balzac's words upon this subject. The smallest as the most immense creations are, but are they not to be distinguished from each other for their qualities? Their quantities, their qualities, and their dimensions, their forces and attributes, all begotten by the number. The infinitude of the numbers is a fact proven in our minds, but of which no proof can be physically given. The mathematician will tell us that the infinitude of numbers exists but is not to be demonstrated. And God is a number endowed with motion, which is felt but not demonstrated. As unity, it begins the numbers with which it has chosen in common. The existence of the number depends on unity. It's getting pretty heavy, folks. I don't know really where to go with it further. I mean, we can just continue to read it, but I'd like to lay back a little bit and think about this, because it just seems to it's a definitely different language originating from the earliest language. It is the earliest language. The translation, God knows how they can do it, English, but it's very very difficult to grasp this in the most logical sense. For a reasonable mind, it's very difficult for a logic craving mind. The whole concept of the human condition, or the whole concept of creation, is in itself boggles the mind. This puny entity that we have called the mind is only limited to 24 characters, or 24 slides, if you will, or pictures per second. So when you think of how slow the mind actually operates, in the sense that it can only take in X amount of information before it stops, this section is kind of blows the mind a little bit, because you're trying to take in so much that's actually primeval, primordial, if you will. I mean, the first language. I don't know if anybody translate that, but they did. And I'm sure through the help of God, or through the help of their hierarchy, that they were able to manifest some form of communicable vehicle that, has kept that company. If you look at car companies or any communications company or any communications system, is what can I say? It's here. And it's very difficult to comprehend, especially in a fast-paced technological world that we're in now. Everybody's glued to a laptop or a table desktop or a handheld computer. It's just all changed, and almost impossible to describe. Only that we see the full society moving over. We see the old worn out things happening. The same politics, the same television, the same people, the same concepts that never change. The need that we have to identify our origin is one of the greatest questions man ever faced. I mean, who am I? How am I? How did I get here? How did anything get here? Why are we still here? Why, what am I supposed to do while I'm here? Everybody's doing everything else differently. What am I doing wrong? Or what am I doing right? And once you have that link, then the stanzas kind of open up for you. Everything does, actually. If you can be linked in some direct way to the God, to the power of God, to the power of the universe, which is God, to the maximum degree, then you would never feel lonely. You would never feel discouraged. You would never feel abandoned. Not at all. And because you are who you are. The world has a place for you, even though you don't think so at this point. So as we move along through this seven stanzas, we have to understand, and we discussed this in the first phase, the existence of a hell. And that came along. But yet, in this text, they talk about the sense of non-being, okay? Of being but not being. Using a pseudonym or are using a messenger, you know, to introduce you under a name that more or less identifies your spirit.
Darkness is the only true, actually, the basis
light, which would without which the latter would never manifest itself or even exist. Light is matter, and matter in dust, in darkness. Sure speed, the spirits. Trying to get through this without. Let me read the next stanza. It's rather long. The next line. Behold, O Landu, the radiant child of the two, the unparalleled refulgent glory, bright space, son of dark space, who emerges from the depths of the great dark waters. It is O Yahu, the younger, he shines forth as the sun. He is the blazing divine dragon of wisdom. The Ika is Shatur, and Shatur takes to itself three, and the union produces the Sapta, in whom are the seven, which become the Triadasa. And the host and the multitudes behold him lifting the veil and unfurling it from east to west. He shuts out the above and leaves the below to be seen as the great illusion. He marks the places for the shining ones and turns the upper into a shoreless sea of fire and the one manifested element into the great waters. Bright space, son of dark space, corresponds to the ray dropped in the first thrill of the new dawn in the great cosmic depths, from which it is reemerges, differentiated as Oyahu, younger, the new life, is to become to the end of this life cycle, the germ of all things. He is the incorporeal man. Contains in himself the divine idea, the generator of light and life, to use an expression of Philo Judaeus, he was called the blazing dragon of wisdom. And he was a student of Jellos and Schlesinger's. Okay. We're just about done here. Let's see if I get this last. I guess we'll stop here tonight. I'm not really sure where we're going any further here. Kind of getting lost in this text. It's a very difficult work, and don't be surprised if you don't understand it, especially in the first reading. This is my third or fourth reading of this, believe it or not, and I still have difficulty translating this, other than to know that everything started with nothing. It was the pulsating feminine, and then through intelligent thought or through some form of two forms of darkness created a light, and therefore you had light and you had the universe created. This was the Big Bang. The Big Bang theory, I guess, and through evolution. And that's pretty much as far as we're going to go with this. I don't know if I'll continue with this topic next week, but at least you you get the first couple stanzas in there, and you go to it yourself. If you want to go to just put in the secret doctrine, all right, and it'll take you right to the Theosophical Society and University Press Online edition, and just put in the secret doctrine, see where it goes. Well, I thank everybody for joining me tonight, and please join me tomorrow night when we have our good friend George Dixon. Not sure what we'll be talking about, but I guarantee it'll be interesting. So have a good night, folks, and